You're listening to Pacifica's Peace Watch. I'm Verna Avery Brown. As Americans prepare for an imminent war in Iraq, Iraqis are also preparing for war in their own way. KPFK's Sonali Kolhatkar spoke earlier this week with Pacifica correspondent Jerry Quickly, who has been on assignment in Baghdad for the past 12 days.
Yeah, well, there's definitely a significant change that's taking place right now. I've been in Baghdad for about 12 days now, and since last night, when word started to get out here about the Washington Post article in which they announced that George Bush was going to be sending a very close time frame. The tension here has ratcheted up quite significantly. The hotel in which I'm staying has taped all the windows in the lobby as well as in all the guest rooms. That's also true of many of the stores here in Baghdad. There are there's a mushrooming number of sandbagged gun emplacements at all the major intersections in Baghdad and many of the lesser intersections as well. There's also an increasing presence of Iraqi army personnel, there is a very large exodus underway to Jordan, to Amman, Jordan, from here in Baghdad. There is it used to cost anywhere from $15 to $30 to get hire a private car to take you to Jordan, to Amman, which is a very cheap. Considering it's about 12 to 15 hours each way, but as of last night, the price has jumped to the lowest price available a few hours ago was $400, and generally it's between $500 or $600, maybe $700. So the car ride that used to be $15 is now $600 to $700, which is one of the many signs here that this is a city indeed on the precipice of war.
So you are seeing basically people fleeing, refugees. Can you talk a little bit about the psychological sentiment, state of mind? Are people, do you see people sort of grimly waiting for this and ready for U.S. Special Forces, or is there just a lot of fear, or both?
Well, there's both, Sonali. There's definitely a lot of fear and concern, but the fear is tempered by resolve, really. The Iraqi people have been at war of one sort or another, involved in war for the last 24 years. So many of the even the middle-aged men have known war most of their lives, and some children, that's all they've known. And so while the overwhelming sentiment among the Iraqi people is for peace and for there to be peace relations between the United States and Iraq, that is by far the overwhelming sentiment. However, there's also the sentiment, the parallel sentiment that, and if there is going to be war, then we will have to defend ourselves because we have no other choice. They say, no war, inshallah, if God wills it so, and if there is war, they'll do what they need to do to defend themselves. I tried to. There are three people that are traveling with me, so to speak. Three Iraqis: my guide and translator, my government minder, and from the tourist office, and the driver. And the government minders, by the way, are regular average Iraqis. They just happen to speak a little bit of English. They're not high level officials by any regard. In any event, I tried to see if I could get them to stay here at the hotel, bring their families here, because I thought it would certainly be a bit safer than wherever their families are now. And they said when a guide said, thank you very much, Jerry, but we can't consider all of Iraq your home. It is my home and my family. I cannot say to my brother that he cannot come, or his wife, or my niece or nephew. And even if I could get all my family into the hotel, I would say no, because all of Iraq is my family. And I stay with my family, and whatever comes will come. We have our God, and we believe in that, and there is nothing else that we can do. But still, there's a chance for no war, inshallah. And it was, very touching, but it was also very frustrating that people that you that I've met here, who have gone out of their way to be gracious and courteous and extremely decent and kind in this very, very difficult time, that there is no ability to provide any safety for them with whatever few meager resources that I have. But the simple reality of it is that there's nothing that can be done because of this war that Bush is creating. The simple fact is that there's 7 to 8 million people in the city, and you can't possibly get even a significant number of them into one or two of the hotels that offer some relative amount of safety.
Jerry, how many reporters are in Baghdad right now? We have, of course, been told that the U.S. military has embedded journalists, and that's how a lot of the reporting is going to be coming from once this war begins. And you are among probably a few independent journalists. Do you know of other independent journalists in Iraq, in Baghdad right now?
I know of two other independent journalists in Baghdad right now. Most of the journalists are in the process of leaving, independent or not. The Ministry of Information had quoted a number of, there were 450 registered journalists in Baghdad as of 4 days ago or 3 days ago. As of yesterday afternoon, the number was 300, and the mass exodus began in earnest last night. So I would imagine by this point, it's just speculation on my part, but I would imagine the number of journalists here has got to have shrunk to somewhere between 1 and 200 as of today, and will probably shrink even more. I don't imagine that there will be more than 50 to 100 journalists left in Baghdad within the next 24 hours.
And are you planning on staying or leaving?
Yes, I will be here. I will be staying in Baghdad. I plan on bearing witness to the atrocities the United States government is about to be engaged in, the atrocities on the Iraqi people. It's not possible to make war in a city like this without killing tens of thousands, if not hundreds of thousands of people. And I plan on continuing to file reports as often as possible, and when I cannot file them, to record them. I hope that the U.S. military won't take all of my footage, my photos, and my reports, but I plan on being here through the hostilities and bearing witness for the Iraqi people, and trying to add just one small, you know, insight of truth as to what's happening.
Do you have a safe place to go to apart, or is your hotel the safest place right now?
The hotel's about the safest place right now. You know, I don't want to overplay the danger of it, because the reality of it is that there's a couple of hotels in town that house journalists. The Al Rashid is probably the safest place in Baghdad, in all of Iraq, because of the number of foreign journalists there. There's also a decent number of foreign journalists at my hotel, the Palestine. And as you know, in terms of relative safety, where I am at is relatively safe. It's certainly much safer than the barracks with the 17-year-old conscripts, or the schoolyards of the children, or the restaurants where the waiters work, or the gas stations where the taxis pull in. There's no safe place in Baghdad, really.
Pacifica correspondent Jerry Quickly speaking with KPFK's Sonali Kalhatar from Baghdad. Sunday was the 15th anniversary of the Halabja massacre, when Saddam Hussein is alleged to have used chemical weapons against the Iraqi Kurds in 1988. Speaking at the summit at the Azores Island off the coast of Portugal, President Bush used the occasion as a reason to support a war on Iraq.
On this very day, 15 years ago, Saddam Hussein launched a chemical weapons attack on the Iraqi village of Halabja. With a single order, the Iraqi regime killed thousands of men and women and children without mercy or without shame.
President Bush speaking Sunday of the 15th anniversary of the Halabja massacre. But Aslam Sarıyıldız reports from southeastern Turkey the vast majority of Kurds do not share George Bush's view of the massacre.
The Kurdish children in a bazaar in Kızıltepe, a mid-sized town in southeastern Turkey, chant that they are against war. Kızıltepe is one of the towns near the border with Iraq where the American army settled its troops. Although they were not living in 1988, these Kurdish children are afraid that if George Bush calls to war, Saddam may attack them with chemical weapons as he did in Halepce. Ahmet works at the Human Rights Association in Kızıltepe.
I have a son who's 12 years old. He asks me if I could buy him a bicycle if Saddam doesn't kill us with bombs. What Saddam has done affects especially women and children very badly.
On March 16, 1988, Saddam bombed his own people with chemical weapons. Western politicians regularly use the incident to say Saddam Hussein is the only dictator in the entire history of humanity who has used chemical bombs on his own people. 5,000 Kurdish people died at Halepce. Thousands more carry the effects in different ways. The harbor border door between Turkey and Iraq, which provides the economic lifeblood of the area, was closed after Halepce, collapsing the economy, just as it has collapsed the economy today. Furthermore, the pressure of the Turkish government on the Kurdish people in Turkey increased during this period. And all Kurdish people of all ages carry the psychological effects of the attack. The Kurdish people in southeastern Turkey believe they will be destroyed by a possible war. Meanwhile, presidents of world powers support a war in their names. Ali Temiz, a Kurdish man and a doctor in Kızıltepe, tries to analyze what is going on. He says, all Kurdish people know America sold all the weapons to Iraq during the war between Iran and Iraq.
Saddam is part of the chess game, and so is Bush. People have to act against what is going on.
On the anniversary of Halepce, when a possible war looming just a few miles away, Turkish Kurds try to answer very hard questions which are put to their lives. Again, Dr. Ali Temiz.
Why Halabja? Why Kurds? It is about power. More birth defects, more profit, but more deaths. These things are happening today.
But despite their frustrations, many Kurds still believe that something can be done and has to be done as soon as possible, taking lessons from their history. The people here have been in some type of war for decades. They say they are tired of war and they want to get rid of all things that war brings. They say they need peace more than any time now.
Kurds are against the war as they have lived the effects of the war in Halabja.
Every day there are many protests all over Turkey against the war. On Friday, four labor and public sector unions came from Ankara, the capital of Turkey, following the ancient trade route called the Silk Road, in bus convoys. They wanted to give the U.S. Army a message to turn back the way they came, back to the Mediterranean port of Iskenderun on their way their home. They were greeted by hundreds of people against war in every city they passed. Sema Taka is with the Office Workers Union.
We absolutely need to make a decision and take responsibility. It's obvious that war can be stopped in Turkey.
But in the Kurdish part of Turkey, the trade union convoy ran into problems. 2 days before the anniversary of Halepce, police attacked the trade unionists in Nusaybin, injuring and arresting dozens of people. But the unionists and the Kurds still believe in fighting for their future. For Pacifica's Peace Watch, I'm Özlem Sarı Yıldız in Kızıltepe, southeastern Turkey.
Saddam Hussein gassed the Kurdish people, killed thousands in a single day. And 12 long years later, Uncle Sam said you can't treat the Kurds this way. And furthermore, all Kurds are freedom fighters. Who'd resist this Iraqi tyranny? And Uncle Sam will give them guns and maybe sometimes ammunition so the brave Kurds can fight until they're free. Meanwhile, in southeastern Turkey, the Turkish army had a unique plan. We'll go burn down 3,000 villages, get rid of what they call Kurdistan. Well, some of these pesky Kurds decided that they would rather fight instead of die. So Uncle Sam said, you are terrorists, because Turkey is our ally. Geopolitics is confusing. In fact, it can be quite absurd, especially if you value your freedom. You live in Turkey and you are a Kurd. Yes, when Iraqi Kurds are massacred.
The impending war with Iraq is a topic of concern for some of those seeking the presidential nomination here in the U.S., among them the Ohio Democrat Dennis Kucinich.
No money for Social Security, no money for Medicare, only money for tax cuts for the rich, and only money for war. That's your money they're spending to send your sons and daughters to war. And in the end, corporate interests will win while fresh new graves are dug on two continents. What would a workers' White House do? Protect this nation when we're attacked, but not attack another nation, so we're forced to protect this nation once again. Use diplomacy to work for disarmament everywhere, not only in Iraq. We've proven that deterrence is the way to avert annihilation. It is the only way. Once we set these weapons at work in the world, the situation goes out of control and war breaks loose around the world. Once again, the hopes of people of two nations are being smashed by weapons in the name of eliminating weapons. Let us abolish weapons of mass destruction. Let us abolish those weapons at home. Corporate control of government is a weapon of mass destruction. Joblessness, a weapon of mass destruction. Poverty is a weapon of mass destruction. Homelessness is a weapon of mass destruction. Poor health care is a weapon of mass destruction. Poor education, a weapon of mass destruction. Discrimination, a weapon of mass destruction. Let us use hundreds of billions of our tax dollars instead for the restoration of the American worker. We have a right to a job. We have a right to decent housing. We have a right to health care. Peace is a precondition which makes all other rights possible. Peace will protect the rights of workers. This is the moment for workers all over America to strengthen the cause of peace.
Democratic presidential candidate Dennis Kucinich of Ohio speaking recently at a meeting of the Iowa AFL-CIO. Former Vermont Governor Howard Dean has also been outspoken in his opposition to the war on Iraq. He's presently a candidate for the President of the United States seeking the Democratic nomination. Peace Watch spoke with Governor Dean today regarding his candidacy, the war on Iraq, and Bush's speech last night.
You know, this is a president who's clearly prepared to go to war and is about to do that. I didn't hear anything new. I think we have a strong difference of opinion about how dangerous Iraq is to the United States. My feeling is that he has not made the case that Iraq doesn't possess nuclear weapons. It doesn't have much of a nuclear program, if it has one at all, and it's not giving weapons to the terrorists. On the other hand, North Korea is doing all three of those things, selling missiles to countries that are our enemies, has a nuclear program, and most likely has nuclear weapons, and he's essentially even refusing to talk to them. So I just don't think that the attack on Iraq fits into any kind of a coherent long-term foreign policy for the defense of the United States.
That seems to be a minority opinion if you read or believe the opinion polls that we're seeing this morning. It seems like, if you believe these polls, that the majority of Americans believe and support the president in this endeavor. Does that does that give you any reason for pause?
Nope. I think you have to do what you think is right. I respect the president's judgment, even though I don't agree with it. I certainly wish our troops well and support them and hope that they get home safely and the mission is successful. But I don't think this is the proper way to conduct foreign policy, nor do I think it's essential for the defense of the United States.
Mm-hmm. In fact, it seems as though the president and his administration, or at least his cabinet members, have decided to abandon diplomacy, a move which seems to be isolating the U.S. and its citizens in the world community. I'm wondering what your reaction is to that, if you feel as though that's a proper assessment of what's happening.
I think it is. I think I have no doubt that the military is going to prevail over Saddam Hussein. My concern is, first of all, when you decide you're going to unilaterally act against a country, without making a case, certainly that most people in the world believe, and I think that a significant number of Americans don't believe, that this is an imminent danger, an imminent threat to the United States, then you set the bar, as the United States usually does, for conduct among other nations. And I think it won't be long, probably within the president's first term, and hopefully there'll only be one term, that we will see another country justifying its aggressive actions against a third country or another country using this president's example. And I think that's a serious problem. I disagree with the president that might makes right. I prefer Abraham Lincoln's view that right makes might, and I think in the long run that is in fact what happens.
Former Governor Dean Tom DeLay, the Republican leader in the House, recently criticized your candidacy for the president and specifically your position on the war with Iraq. DeLay said that you disqualified yourself for national leadership by suggesting that the decision to go to war should be made by the United Nations. Talking about you, he said, quote, if he wants to be president of the United States but subject the United States to decisions by the UN, he lacks the sound judgment needed for responsible national leadership, unquote. What's your response to that?
We didn't bother to respond to that. I think Mr. DeLay's views are well known. He has a long history of intemperate remarks and ad hominem attacks, and I don't think there's any particular reason to reply to those kinds of remarks. I don't think Mr. DeLay has much standing among the American people or even, frankly, in the moderate wing of his own party. So
he is a Republican leader, however.
He is, but I think that's a sad commentary on where the Republicans are right now. To elect someone with such extreme views as Tom DeLay, who preaches creationism in the school, teaching a creationism in the schools, among other things, I think is exactly why I'm in this race. I think this party's been hijacked by the right wing, and I think the presidency has been hijacked by the right wing, and I really don't think that I need to have any much more response than that.
Isn't, however, the Congress, wasn't that intended to be sort of a checks and balance system for our government and our system, the way it works? And do you feel as though the Congress is functioning in that manner at all with respect to this war against Iraq? The country itself seems to be divided around this issue, and yet that's not apparent in the way that the Congress is responding
well,
to this.
Well, I've repeatedly said that I have some real disappointments with people in my own party. Now, as I say, the president's judgment and Joe Lieberman's judgment, which are similar in this reign, I disagree with them, but I respect their judgments. That is, Joe voted to attack Iraq, and he believes that that's the right thing to do, and I don't agree with that, but I respect Joe Lieberman, and I like him, and I think he's being consistent, which is important. The president's great strength is that he's being consistent, which is the weakness of our party, because the other candidates have been flapping around. Now, John Edwards appears to be now sticking by his views, but we've heard speeches from John Kerry, from Dick Gephardt, from John Edwards, all of whom I personally like and intend to support should they win the nomination. But what they're saying is, well, we didn't like the war, but we voted in favor of it. Now we're really only trying to get them to the United Nations. I know what that resolution said. It said that we give the power to the president to decide when and if he will attack Iraq. And there are no strings attached. There's an urging to do this and urging to do that. I think that was a mistake. And I think the big mistake is not so much voting for the war, which I disagree with, but trying to have it both ways. You can't do that anymore and win elections. People are too smart for that. And they're just not going to do it. I think the Democratic Party needs to stand up for what it believes in. Now, I happen to believe that this war is a mistake, and I'm going to continue to say that. I didn't arrive at that position by looking at the polls or wondering where they'd be 9 months from now. I thought through the foreign policy and defense implications of sending 250,000 people to Iraq when we are refusing to even deal with the larger crisis, which is North Korea, to say nothing of the fact that we're really, I think, falling behind in the war on terror. So I just see this as a big problem for the party, because I think people, other than a few of them that I've named, haven't made their views clear, and secondly, because I think we suspect that we're going to beat George Bush by taking over his policies and co-opting them, and in fact, that's not true. This president's popular because he knows who he is and he's comfortable with his message. I'd like to oppose him because I know who I am. I'm comfortable with the message, and it's a very different message that I think most Americans will embrace.
Well, some in the Democratic Party have said that it was illegal, actually, for the Congress to abrogate its authority to the president to use force, and have filed a number of lawsuits, or have filed at least one lawsuit. The courts, however, have not tended to agree with them. I'm wondering about the legality of this war, in your opinion. Others have said that it's in violation of the U.N. Charter to move forward in this manner, a preemptive strike against Iraq. And many within the peace movement have said that this is an illegal war. What are your thoughts around the legality of this war?
I'm a doctor, and I can talk health policy very, very well. I'm not as well-versed in international or law. But let me make the following observations that I believe, and I'm certainly willing to listen to other people's opinions on this. I unfortunately do not agree that this is an illegal war. I think the president, although he blustered in January about going to war without even the permission of the Congress, which I was appalled at, he did in fact get permission of the Congress. And that's what's required under the Constitution. They voted it to allow him to do this. Now, so I don't believe that from an American point of view this is a violation of American law. I think there is a case to be made that it's a violation of international law. And this is an area that I would really require some very smart legal opinions. But it seems to me, if not the letter, then certainly the spirit, the United Nations exists to keep the peace, to deal with the disarming people like Saddam Hussein. I think that Saddam should be disarmed, but I think it should have been done by the United Nations since he doesn't pose an immediate threat to the United States. So I think the question of international law is less clear. I suspect there may be a violation of international law, certainly a violation of the spirit of what the United Nations is supposed to be about. But I don't believe there's much of a case to be made, even as a lay person, that is against American law, because I think the president did go to Congress and he did get widespread support.
What about this whole policy of regime change with regard to Saddam Hussein? I've spoken to many Americans that are offended by the idea that the U.S. would determine or decide that a dictator or the president of another country should be removed and use its military might to ensure that that happens.
I think that's a muddy area. I agree in this particular case because I think the ethics of attacking a country which is not a threat to us are troublesome. So there are cases when regime change is justified. I actually believe that the United States has an obligation as the only superpower in the world to intervene in cases of where genocide is going on if the United Nations refuses to honor its obligations.
Former Vermont governor and presidential aspirant Howard Dean. Pacifica's Peace Watch is produced in Washington, D.C. Our producer is Scott Gurian. Our editor is Lona Elias. Our associate producer is Angelique Shafar. Our engineer is Granger Helvey. We had production assistance from Adil Hamad of KPFA, David Russo, Eddie Becker, Benta Berklin, and Keith Shaljian. Thanks to Pete Caracas, RadioForAll.net, and Shane Rock at WebActive.com for web help. Special thanks also to our consulting producer, Sam Husseini. Copies of this program can be ordered from the Pacifica Radio Archives by visiting the website at pacificaarchives.org or by calling 1-800-735-0230. If you'd like to support this type of programming, we urge you to visit pacifica.org and make a pledge through our secure online website. I'm Verna Avery Brown, the executive producer. Thank you for listening.